Hello, I'm Dave Emery. This is Side 1 of For the Record program number 754, titled The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, Dramatis Personae. This has been recorded on September 1st of the year 2013. We are going to continue from where we began, really, in For the Record 353. I gave an overview of the, quote, disclosures, unquote. Most of this information, the vast bulk of it, has been on the public record for well over 10 years, of Eddie Snowden, the guy I call Eddie the Friendly Spook. Please reference For the Record 354. I have already written the equivalent of a small book about this. I have 19 posts to date. A 20th post will be up by the end of the week. And it is a very long and complex analysis and investigation. Suffice it to say that things are other than what they seem. Eddie Snowden is a professional intelligence officer. He is a spook. That's why I call him Eddie the Friendly Spook. And remember, he is a spy, and spy rhymes with lie. In the first part of our discussion, For the Record program 353, I referenced a passage from Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler's political manifesto and, to an extent, autobiography. And there is a passage in there that goes roughly as follows. I'm paraphrasing slightly. Most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big ones. They would never credit others with such great impudence as a complete reversal of facts. Even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, as any trifling detail would dispose them to accept the thing as true. All good liars know this, therefore, and stop at nothing to achieve this end. I also referenced a social psychology experiment in which two lines are drawn on a blackboard, one very much longer than the other, and the group of people who are in on the experiment are all told to say that the longer line is the shorter line, and vice versa. An experimental subject, who is the last person to be called upon, is then tested, and sometimes they last beyond the first two or three go-rounds, but almost inevitably they begin to say that the longer line, and one is very obviously longer than the other, is in fact the shorter line, and that the shorter line is the longer line. Both the passage from Mein Kampf and that social psychology experiment should be borne in mind, because what we are looking at in terms of the general representation of this is the complete reversal of facts. I also, as we proceed into what is going to be a long series of shows and a very complex and multi-layered analysis, I want to stress that I am not endorsing things like hacking the computers of other countries or tapping phones, etc. These are simply things that are done. However, the way that this is playing out is not good at all. And it is, in fact, the opposite of the way it has been represented, particularly by our more so-called progressive or liberal news media. In fact, the overall, the net, so to speak, of Snowden's rod, as I call it, is very likely to be extremely bad indeed. I realize that may sound strange. People may be thinking, well, gee, you know, shouldn't we be safeguarding our privacy, civil liberties, etc.? Well, that certainly is a reasonable question, although, as I indicated in the first part of the program, your civil liberties went by the board a long time ago, and people really didn't miss them. And in the current technological age, there really is no such thing as privacy. I would be far more worried if I were you about corporations and private interests accessing this kind of data, and they do, and there are indications that the Palantir firm, in fact, they certainly contract with large corporations, and although they disclaim it, Palantir is the maker of the Prism software. By the way, people who would like to get a jump, so to speak, on my analysis of The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, can go to the SpitfireList.com website, bring up the news and supplemental category, and I have 19 posts. By the end of the week, I will have 20 posts on the subject. And again, for newer listeners, I am recovering from major, major oral surgery and have no lower front teeth. And that is a temporary situation. It will be corrected. It is in the process of being corrected, although it is a long process. So if I sound a little bit like Elmer Fudd or Daffy the Duck, there is a very good reason for that. Now, we're going to plunge right into this. And I think before we launch into our long, detailed analysis of this, I think it may help to clarify things for people, to set the dramatis personae. Who are the individuals in this drama, and what are they like? What are their real affiliations? Because, again, in addition to Eddie the Friendly Spook, the spy Eddie Snowden, the people and the elements represented here are other. The people and elements participating in this drama are other than the way they have been represented. In fact, when you begin examining the dramatis personae, what you begin to see, and what we're going to take a real long, scary look at in this program, is what I call the Underground Reich. People will think, my goodness, this guy is, he is really out there, an Underground Reich. Yes, the Third Reich, which was not an aberration in the first place, went underground. I can appreciate that sounds crazy. I have books and many materials on the website for download for free to educate yourselves. Three books I would recommend: The Nazis Go Underground from 1944, The New Germany and the Old Nazis from 1961, and Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile from 1981. Also the Carl Oglesby essay, The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, which documents the fact that not only was the Galen organization a front for Odessa Nazis, but that as Galen was transitioning to his work for CIA, he was clearing his actions with Admiral Karl von Dönitz and with General Franz Halder, his former chief of staff, indicating that as Galen was jumping to the CIA and his entire Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit was becoming the U.S.'s eyes and ears on the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, the German chain of command was still in effect. It was basically a Trojan horse, or as the late Colonel William Corson said, it was just a front for Odessa Nazis. So again, as we begin to look at, as we look at the people in this drama, the dramatis personae, we are going to see people who gravitate to the Underground Reich and the far right, including our hero, Eddie the Friendly Spook, Snowden. Now, we're going to begin by taking a look at Citizen Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian journalist who has been Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden's leaking journalist of choice. Bear in mind as you hear this that Glenn Greenwald is also very close to WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks is very much a part of this whole story. We're going to talk about WikiLeaks, time permitting, later in this program, or perhaps in our next broadcast. We have already spoken about WikiLeaks and its far-right and Nazi connections. in For the Record programs 7:32 and 7:45. The two posts in which I deal with Glenn Greenwald are Snowden's Ride, Part 6, Why Did Glenn Greenwald Represent Neo-Nazis Pro Bono?, and also Snowden's Ride, Part 7, Citizen Greenwald, the National Alliance, and the Underground Reich. And I am going to be reading the titles of the articles and posts that I have excerpted here, and reading short sections of it. I'm not going to read the whole posts, the entire texts, because with my limited chops, that's just not a possibility. But I'm going to do the best I can. And again, this is Glenn Greenwald, the darling of the so-called progressive sector. Before Glenn Greenwald became a journalist, he was a lawyer. He not only did some corporate law, he also had his own law firm, and for many years he represented some of the most heinous and most murderous Nazi groups. And in fact, he did most of that work pro bono. Again, this post is titled Snowden's Ride, Part 6, Why Did Glenn Greenwald Represent Neo-Nazis Pro Bono? And in the post, How Glenn Greenwald Became Glenn Greenwald by Jessica Testa at BuzzFeed.com, June 26, 2013, we read, Greenwald also spent roughly 5 years defending the First Amendment rights of neo-Nazis, including Matthew Hale, the Pontifex Maximus of the Illinois Church, formerly known as the World Church of the Creator, one of whose disciples went on a murderous spree in 1999. I almost always did it pro bono, Greenwald said. I was interested in defending political principles that I believed in. One wonders just what those principles might be. No doubt, Greenwald would say civil liberties, free speech, etc. Let's take a look at just what he did. And by the way, he had his own law firm, and he practiced law with a fellow named Werner Aschatz. That was his partner slash boyfriend for some 11 years, and he also worked with him practicing law. Later on, we're going to speculate if that was all that there was to that relationship, the legal and romantic slash sexual relationship. I suspect there may have been more to it. In a post on the Democratic Underground website called Glenn Greenwald Unethically Taped Witnesses While Working for Matt Hale, White Supremacist, we read a number of things. First of all, again, Matthew Hale. By the way, I mistakenly identified him in our last program as the founder of the World Church of the Creator. He was the leader of it. He did not found it. But one of his followers who had appeared as a character witness at Matthew Hale's hearing, because he was applying to be a lawyer, was a guy named Benjamin Nathaniel Smith. He went on a long shooting rampage in two different states, shooting Jews and black people and so forth. He then was sued by some of the relatives and also some of the shooting victims themselves. They sued Matthew Hale, charging that basically by inciting his followers to this type of activity, he was therefore liable for the actions of Benjamin Smith. And again, Glenn Greenwald, Citizen Greenwald, represented Matthew Hale pro bono for some 5 years. By the way, Hale is now serving a 40-year sentence in prison for plotting against the life of a judge. Now, one of the things that is brought to one of the points emphasized in this post, first of all, the FBI actually visited Glenn Greenwald, alleging that he may have passed coded messages by hail while proscribed from doing so. That is, at this point, open-ended. What is very interesting here to me is the fact, first of all, that Glenn Greenwald called the people who were suing Matthew Hale odious and repugnant. And he said, basically, I find the people behind these lawsuits so truly odious and repugnant that creates its own motivation for me. I wonder just what it was that was so repugnant. The fact that they were Jewish, the fact that they were black, the fact that they got shot by Hale's Nazi foot soldier. It's interesting verbiage. I will also note that while representing Matthew Hale, Glenn Greenwald taped witnesses and was leading these witnesses on and actually was called to account by the judge in this case because he violated two separate rules of jurisprudence. The judge said as follows, quote, the magistrate judge granted both motions, actually quoting from the Post, the magistrate judge granted both motions, finding defense counsel's conduct unethical under two separate rules, Local Rule 8358 and the legal code for that, prohibiting, quote, dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, unquote, and Local Rule 8354-4, stating, quote, a lawyer shall not use methods of obtaining evidence that violate the legal rights of person, unquote. And again, the judge upheld two plaintiff complaints or objections in court. It's unclear whether Greenwald surreptitiously taped these clients, in other words, without their notion. What I would note here is that there really is nothing different in principle for what Greenwald was doing here in his years-long pro bono defense of his Nazi client than what the NSA was doing and what he so vociferously objects to. And again, he spent 5 years doing this sort of thing. In the same Post, and again, he tried to manipulate witnesses. He was leading the witnesses and taping them at the same time, and he was basically reprimanded by the magistrate in this case. There was a letter to the editor of The Nation magazine alleging that Glenn Greenwald is a conservative libertarian mole within the progressive community. Again, that's called Letter to the Nation magazine. Glenn Greenwald is a conservative libertarian mole. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I would simply note that for the record. And I would note that it is reproduced in its entirety in that Post. Snowden's Ride, Part 6. Why did Glenn Greenwald represent neo-Nazis pro bono? That was not the only time that Glenn Greenwald represented Nazis pro bono. In yet another Post, this is Snowden's Ride, Part 7, Citizen Greenwald, the National Alliance, and the Underground Reich. We note that another of the Nazi clients that Glenn Greenwald represented, apparently pro bono, was the National Alliance. Now, we have spoken about the National Alliance many times over the years. They are the publishers of the Turner Diaries, about which we will have more to say later. They are the publishers of Serpent's Walk, which we have spoken about so many times. They also published a book called Hunter, which was crafted by William Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, specifically as sort of a motivational and instructional manual for racist assassins. Hunter is about a racist assassin who goes around killing people of color and mixed race couples in particular. It is dedicated to Joseph Paul Franklin. Now, we are going to go into Greenwald's representation of the National Alliance. And I want to note a couple of things before we actually get into the case that is relevant here. The National Alliance's publishing arm, again, that published Serpent's Walk, that published the Turner Diaries, that published Hunter, specifically publishes these books as, in part anyway, instructional and motivational tools. Serpent's Walk, I would say, is more of a political manifesto. However, the Turner Diaries and Hunter are basically to motivate people to do what they read in the books. And William Pierce was very explicit about saying that Hunter was written and published as a motivational tool. In the History Commons website, there was a post, 1988, Neo-Nazi Group Founds Publishing House, Publishes Book to Inspire White Assassins, and it's about William Pierce and the Neo-Nazi National Alliance, Glenn Greenwald's client. Skipping down, he, meaning William Pierce, dedicates Hunter to Joseph Paul Franklin, convicted of the sniper murders of two African-American men. Pierce will later tell his biographer that he wrote Hunter as a deliberate motivational tool for assassins, saying, quote, "From the beginning with Hunter, I had this idea of how fiction can work as a teaching tool in mind." I would also note here that what we are looking at with people like Benjamin Nathaniel Smith and some of the interests that have been motivated by Hunter or the Turner Diaries, we are looking at a manifestation of something called leaderless resistance. This is a tactic that has been embraced by neo-Nazis and white supremacists in order to avoid infiltration. Individuals and small cells, small groups of individuals, operate on their own ideological motivational basis to do things like committing murders, bank robberies, terrorist incidents, to avoid infiltration. And basically what Glenn Greenwald has been doing with his legal representation of the rights of free speech of people like Nathaniel Hale, the World Church of the Creator, the National Alliance of William Pierce, he is, Greenwald that is, quite literally running legal interference for the leaderless resistance strategy. Now, what we're going to look at is the case that inspired or led to directly Glenn Greenwald representing the National Alliance as well as some other racist and white supremacist groups in 2000 or pursuant to 2000. On the website of the Jewish Defense Organization, there is this account of the particular crime. This is what transpired. In September of 2000, two local racist skinheads posing as home building contractors to lure two Mexican day laborers to a warehouse where the white supremacists stabbed and nearly beat the immigrants to death. One of the assailants was tattooed with swastikas. The other had a tattoo on his stomach of a skinhead menacing a kneeling Jew. The two Latinos, Perez and Escamilla, were Mexican Chicano day laborers residing in Farmingville, New York. Escamilla was bludgeoned by Slavin until he lost consciousness. Perez, too, was clubbed by Slavin and was stabbed several times by Wagner. Escamilla eventually regained consciousness, and both plaintiffs managed to escape. They were aided by a passing motorist who summoned the police. Now, again, they were represented by counsel and filed a lawsuit alleging that a consortium of organizations bore liability for basically having encouraged exactly this sort of behavior. And Glenn Greenwald basically got them off the hook. He was clearing the way, basically, legally, for the leaderless resistance strategy. Among the posts that talk about this, about Glenn Greenwald's work, by the way, The Day the Bloggers Won by Erica Baylert, B-O-E-H-L-E-R-T, from Salon.com of May 19th, 2007. Speaking of Greenwald, in 2002, he defended a strident anti-immigration group, the National Alliance, in a New York civil rights lawsuit after two Mexican day workers were beaten and stabbed on Long Island by two men posing as contractors in search of laborers. I love the phrasing, a strident anti-immigration group. No, this is a Nazi group, and we're going to talk about this group a little bit later on in the program. Another post talking about Greenwald. This from the First Amendment Center website. Anti-immigrant groups can't be held liable for attack by the Associated Press. This on September 16th of 2002. And it talks about Glenn Greenwald's representation of the successful representation of the National Alliance in this particular case. The newspaper also reported that the lawsuit claimed that the philosophy of two white supremacist organizations, including the West Virginia-based National Alliance and the American Patrol in Sherman Oaks, California, urged racial violence against Latino immigrants and other racial minorities. Greenwald then commented, quote, "The lawsuit was a very dangerous attempt to start imposing liability and punishment on groups because of their political and religious views. Glenn Greenwald, the Manhattan attorney representing the National Alliance and other groups, was quoted by Newsweek as saying, quote, "If you can be liable for the actions of other people who hear your views, then you would be afraid to ever express any views that were ever unconventional." Well, the views they're basically expressing do more or less explicitly encourage this kind of activity. Again, Hunter and the Turner Diaries, explicitly Hunter, was crafted as a motivational and instructional document. And one of the things that we are going to do in the second side of this is to take a look at some of the individuals and groups who were apparently motivated by the teaching tools of the National Alliance, whose right to do just such teaching was successfully defended by Citizen Greenwald in this particular case. Now, again, we are going to be talking about the dramatis personae. I think that beginning with the individuals and institutions in this case, we will find it easier later to comprehend the complex and multi-layered analysis. I have already posted 19 posts. By the end of this week, we'll have a 20th post about what I call Snowden's Ride, The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden. You can go to the SpitfireList.com website, go to the news and supplemental section, and you can find those posts there. And we're going to be doing a long series of programs about those. Again, SpitfireList.com, my whole life's work is up there for free for download, as well as a small library of anti-fascist books. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 754, The Adventures of Eddie the Friendly Spook, Part 1, Dramatis Personae. This is being recorded on September 1st of the year 2013. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.